You talk too much.
Thank you.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another show of Uncharted Conversations. Today, we have two special guests, Anne and Vera. And these ladies, they're social workers, and they work in hospitals, and they help families and patients and doctors and nurses who are helping other people. And they're going to describe to us today what it is that they do exactly, because obviously I don't have a very good idea. Anyways, but I've had a chance to talk to them before the show, and I think you'll find this very interesting. So, Vera, tell us a little bit about you and where you're from and a little bit about your childhood.
Oh, boy. Well, I'm Vera. I am a licensed clinical social worker. I work at the healthcare setting. I'm originally from Texas. I grew up with my young mother and my brother. And what brought me to my profession?
Yes.
Well, I really didn't know what I wanted to do for quite some time. I just kind of bounced around from job to job. But then I just really found the niche to help people. In what capacity, I didn't know yet. But I always did like the healthcare field. I just felt I wasn't smart enough to, you know, be a doctor or a nurse. And I came across a healthcare medical social worker. And kind of this is where I landed.
Okay. Anne, tell us about you.
I am a Florida girl. I was born and raised here, so with my parents and an older brother. And I lived on and off in Florida for most of my life. I got into social work, kind of similar to Vera. I think a lot of us do it that way, where it's you're kind of traipsing along in life, trying to figure out what you're going to do, not sure. One of the cool things about social work is that it's you can work across a lot of different fields, but we both were definitely drawn to, I would say, medical social work, hospitals. And I think it's just a unique place to land because it's always a different day. It's never just, you know, the same story. You might see the same people, but it'll always be a different day, different hour.
Absolutely.
That's great. Well, thank you for sharing. You know, I always thought that social workers were more like work with the courts and the legal system. So I found it pretty fascinating that there's healthcare social workers. And I found it pretty fascinating what you were describing to me, what you guys do. So let's go back to Vera. Vera, tell us, what does a healthcare social worker do? And try to give us a little explanation of how you interact with the different people.
Well, I am the ICU caseworker. Social worker. We do a lot of discharge planning, but since we're a specialty, like the ICU is a specialty unit, I deal more with families, the crisis that's going on, you know, because of their loved one. I work closely with the medical team in, you know, trying to explain to the family and, you know, in simple terms of what's going on with the patient. I do a lot of end of life discussions. You know, a lot of our patients are intubated and you know, they may not come out of what's going on. So that's really more what I do. I deal more with the families, the doctors, and just those kind of discussions as opposed to a lot of, like, getting them out of the hospital, the discharge planning side of things. That's really more what I do.
It sounds to me from our earlier conversations, Anne, that you were a little bit more in the administration part and handle some of the stuff that Vera was saying that, well, she says she works with the patients and the doctors and she's not too much involved in getting people out of the hospital. So explain to us today, what do you do?
I would say that I am very vocal, so that's how I end up involved with administration. I do kind of the complex trauma ICU and trauma patients. And so similar to Vera, it's a lot of integrating and helping with the interdisciplinary team. So the nurses, the doctors, respiratory therapists, physical, occupational therapy, but really also helping them be coordinated and interact with the families as cohesive as we can. You know, the doctor's going to change, the nurse is going to change daily, all of those people are going to change, but the family knows that they can rely on us to be their constant person throughout the hospitalization. And I think that's one of the biggest components, especially being in the specialty ICUs, because we really spend a lot of time with the families. So I would say a lot of my day is kind of going and checking on different families who are in different stages of their hospitalization, whether it's a new family coming in and their loved ones, we've just discovered who the patient is and we've just found, because we get a lot of John and Jane Does at the hospital, so it takes us a little while to figure out who they are. And once we figured it out, we're calling the family to tell them that they're there, to, you know, starting to talk about what it's going to look like to leave the hospital after being hospitalized for 6 months. So
wow. We also talked a little bit prior to the show about what kind of needs that, you know, the jobs that you ladies do, being social workers, you take care of the people in the hospital, but you also have to try to help them get out of the hospital sometimes. Mm-hmm. And you were mentioning that there's not a lot of places sometimes for people. Can you ladies expand a little bit more about that?
Well, I will turn that to Anne because she's more of an expert on that. Usually my patients either go to hospice or they end up passing away. So I don't do a lot of placements. I don't have a lot of those issues.
Yeah, that's one way to leave the hospital.
Exactly.
Well, we like to be a little frank, they call it death or discharge.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
DC to JC, you know. Yeah. So Anne would probably better answer that one because a lot of her patients do tend to be more complex, and finding placement does become very difficult based on the needs that her patients will have. So Anne, take it away.
So I think in a city like we are in, there is a large population of poorly or unfunded people. They come to us in the worst time of their life, whether it's because they've had, you know, they've been hit by a car. We have a lot of pedestrian versus auto in this city. Or it's that they have a new diagnosis that they, you know, probably has been, you know, brewing, but they haven't come. They wait until they have to go to the hospital for something else and they find out they're diagnosed with something new. Or they're in the middle of a trauma because they've just been, you know, flown in from another state. You know, we get a lot of people from out of town. So the unique situation that this patient population finds themselves in, which means we find ourselves in, is that at the end of the day, they can't live in the hospital. And they don't want to. And so ultimately, you know, it's trying to set them up to be in the safest environment we can. And it sometimes that means they're getting to go home. Sometimes that means they're going to an ALF or a rooming house. They might be going to back to the shelter. They might be going to a skilled nursing facility or things like that. But sometimes they're just going back to the street. And sometimes I think that's also a unique situation. And people don't realize that we would actually discharge people back to the street. But a lot of them prefer to live on the street. And we'll see them the next time they come back in.
So my day job, and I'm a real estate developer, mm-hmm. and so I was listening to our conversations earlier, and I think that maybe if somebody like me or group that I could put together would go out there and rehabilitate some homes or build some structures where some of these people who have no place to go, do you think this would be a good thing? Would this help the community?
So from my time of working in a nonprofit that housed the homeless population, I can say 70% of homelessness self-resolves and 30% doesn't because of brain trauma. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times these people are disconnected because they do not feel like they're connected with humanity anymore. They're not connected with people anymore. Mm-hmm. So they associate themselves with living where they live now. It takes a lot of effort and rehabilitation to get people back indoors. They become so accustomed to living on the street because of mental health issues and physical brain trauma that happens.
I would agree. So I think to both aspects, it's very true. I had a patient who, not getting too much into it, but I mean, he would go around the unit and you could see him digging through the trash because that's how, and I remember someone saying there's a guy digging through the trash on such and such unit. And I was like, well, that's what he does. I mean, that's how he's comfortable. He's so acclimated to that lifestyle that even bringing him indoors, he's still going to live that way. But that being said, there are a lot of them who might be newer to being homeless or newer to needing to not having a, you know, their family not letting them come back, things like that, who could really, before they get as far as the gentleman who's so comfortable digging through the garbage, but getting them into housing that is more affordable. You know, most of these patients and most of the people in this city, I would say, who are getting their Social Security are probably getting the minimum, which is only about $732 a month.
Wow.
Which is less than we all got for the COVID check.
I will say social services save lives.
Yeah.
When it comes to those who are underprivileged and underfunded, getting people social services to get them off the streets saves lives. That's how we get that 70% housed again.
Yeah.
Well, our conversations today have opened my brain up a little bit, and I'm going to start looking for areas and places where I could actually make a difference and help the community by coming up with some affordable housing for people coming out of the healthcare system. But also, I think we were talking about how the families that mm-hmm. come into town mm-hmm. to visit the people mm-hmm. sometimes don't have places to stay. Tell us about that.
I'm going to talk about that here, because I've definitely experienced it.
I've experienced it with some of our families who are in the ICU and coming in from Georgia or, you know, down south, and they come up and it's, you know, the first thing they'll ask me is, where can I stay, or do you guys provide housing, because, you know, we have to rent a hotel or we have to rent a B&B and we can't do it for X amount of days. You know, and unfortunately, you know, my answer is like, we don't have, you know, a place across the street, you know, where we can house you. So we do encounter that, and I do feel bad for some of these families because their loved one is, you know, in the ICU, possibly dying, and, you know, they can't be, you know, across the street to come over right away if something came about. They have to go back to their hotel or some, even have to go back to their state that they came from. So there's definitely a need for a shelter for these families to stay at and be able to have access to their loved one, you know, right away. So I've dealt with those type of families, I think, and also probably a lot more than I have.
I think one of the things is we're reliant on these people oftentimes to make decisions for the patient or their loved one, and you can't really expect someone to make a sound decision when, you know, they're sleeping in the recliner next to them in the hospital room, or they don't know where they're going to sleep. Or, I mean, we definitely have people who are sleeping in their cars downstairs because they're so afraid to leave the property, or they can't afford to leave it. You know, they've flown in from wherever or driven in from wherever, and they're also looking at, you know, how much it's going to cost to take care of this person. So I think one of the most interesting things is that we rely on these people to make big decisions, but we're not setting them up or supporting them in a way that could help them make better decisions.
Many years ago, one of my college teachers, I was studying industrial engineering, I was a freshman, and he told the class, find a need and fill it. So by our conversations today, I'm seeing
lots of needs
and lots of potential. I'm sure there'll be many people like myself, real estate developer people, that will be listening to this show. And folks, pay attention. There's a need here. You would also have an opportunity to help the community by filling these needs. Anyways, thank you so much for sharing all of this with me and with our listeners. I would like to ask another question, because I recently had a death in my family, and it was my sister, and she was in hospice. Mm-hmm. And the people that were helping her were so compassionate and so professional. And, you know, a lot of people, such as myself, were not medical people. And I had a guy once on a job many years ago in Miami. He cut himself right in front of me. He kind of like went into shock because he was working with a machine that almost cut his arm off. So I had to get out of the truck and grab his arm and keep it together. And that was a little bit traumatizing for me. I don't do well with medical stuff. So the question I have for you ladies, like when you're new and you first start working and you get into the field, what kind of adjustments do you have to make because you see this pain, you see this loss, you see the families, you see the patients. So how easy is it for somebody in the medical field to adjust and not take that home with them every day?
Well, for me, it's, you know, I I feel like my service is just very emotionally draining. So every day I have to just go in and be like, okay, you know, you have three meetings today and we're talking about, you know, compassionately weaning somebody. So I just have to prepare myself and just go in, okay, this is what I'm going to talk about. And when I leave, I'm going to go sit with my colleagues and just, you know, talk about it and just have them make me laugh. And, you know, to just go about my day. So it's just really about having a group that you're able to talk to and laugh and just have them, you know, take that stress away. I would say laughter is the best medicine. So really prepare myself and then, you know, go laugh about it.
Well, that's cool that your coworkers help you release some steam.
Recover.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yes.
I think, so as a new person, it can be overwhelming for sure. Mm-hmm. The best way to get comfortable with it is to kind of just jump in, and you'll find out where your limits are and things like that. We're fortunate that we have a good office that we can, you know, I think they'll tell you that people in healthcare have probably some of the darkest senses of humor that you've encountered.
Oh, absolutely.
That's the way you cope with it. And you'll, you know, I mean, we say some stuff that would probably make people be like, oh my God, there's something wrong with them. But, you know, I mean, it's just, it's a coping skill. And you also have to set healthy boundaries too, sure. Because, you know, these families, they get attached to you and they're going to call you and it's, and, you know, I'll tell them, I say, you can call me after this time, but I'm not going to answer it. So leave me a message, send me a text message, because they're up at 2 o'clock in the morning, stressed and thinking about what's happening with their loved one. So they're going to send you the text message, but I'm going to, you know, but I'm not answering it. And I think that's one of the hardest things in our field to do, is to learn healthy boundaries, because you could do this job 24/7 and never be done.
Absolutely.
You know, people would call you, doctors, nurses, families, your boss. They're going to call you as long as they know that you're going to answer. So it's definitely setting some healthy boundaries, because otherwise you can, as Beer said, it's really emotional and you can get burnt out pretty quick. So you have to learn coping skills and boundaries. You have to, you know, I don't think it's for everyone either, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always say, I have banker's hours, is what I tell my families.
Yeah.
I am available here for you Monday through Friday from 8 to 4:30. And they'll laugh, but I'm like, but I am here and I will get back to you as soon as I can. And, you know, they understand that.
And there is, you know, when we're gone, there's other social workers, case managers, chaplains in the building. There's chaplains in the building 24/7. So
the support is there.
That's comforting to know. Mm-hmm. I should learn something from that, because I work long days and people have got always my investors, my customers, my friends, family. I'm always picking up the phone, and I should learn some healthy boundaries as well.
Yes.
Agreed. You can't help people if you don't help yourself first.
Yeah. I've learned a lot of stuff today.
Yeah. If you don't help yourself first and you're not healthy at baseline on your own, like, then you cannot do this job for sure. Yeah. And we've all struggled, and I've cried at work. I've been angry at work. I mean, and it's hard, but it's also like it's so rewarding. And like, we get to be a part of, like, it's such a unique position, because we get to be a part of people's lives at the worst and sometimes best moments too. And so it's such a unique, like, rewarding position to be in.
And get your little group that you can love and argue, but love each other again.
We are around each other more than we are anybody else in our lives. And so, I mean, we laugh, we fight, we
cry.
I mean, we were just telling you before, like, one of our coworkers is also one of our good friends who would be here. But, you know, we've been supporting her as she's losing a family member herself. So we also have to remember, like, yes, we do all this stuff at work, but we still have stuff that happens that's crappy out on the outside too.
Wow. So I heard that you ladies are thinking about starting your own podcast, and we can talk about that in a second before we close out. But I'd like to ask you if you could, if you were giving somebody some advice who was going to follow in your path, what would you tell them to do or to look out for, or how to follow that path?
Well, for me, I just say you really got to find that passion, you know, for helping others. You got to find that niche, you know, that calling. And for me, this was it. So for anybody that's whatever field you go into, especially the social work field, because we are so unique, you really have to have that passion to help others and serve others. So my advice would be find a passion, find your niche, you know, and go out there and try to save one person at a time.
Awesome advice. How about you, Ann?
So I think try different aspects. So one thing that's really unique about social work is that, as you said, you thought of us in the court system. So we are involved in the court system. We're involved in DCF, Department of Children and Families in Florida, and every other state it has a different name. School social workers, private, so like licensed clinical social workers can do private practice. They work with veterans at the VA. There's so many different aspects of social work that, like, even now they're growing. Like during COVID, when they realized that, you know, providing mental health support for people in their job and workplace. So like Delta was hiring like LCSWs. There's so many different things that you can do with social work, which is really cool. It definitely helps to try different things. And when you get in there, you have to really be, like Vera said, be willing to, you know, it's a giving job. It's a job of empathy and compassion. And I think that jumping feet first, like you have to be willing to get down in the nitty gritty with people. And if you can do that, you'll find what works for you. Yeah, you know, I think that we both found that we definitely like, you know, there's other places we could go work where everyone has health insurance and they have a house to go home to, but it doesn't feel like I could really, I'm helping or serving a population. Whereas here, it's like, okay, how are we going to put this together today? So
I want to thank you for your service and your compassion, because I can tell from our conversation here today that it really drives both of you ladies. Okay, so now tell us about this new podcast you want to make.
Well, I'm going to let Anne take it away because I think it really originated from her. But it's definitely about social work and the healthcare. But Anne, you could dive into this one.
So we have found, you know, we both have our master's in social work. So we went to grad school. You take classes in all kinds of things. You take classes in the DSM-5, which is like diagnosing. You take classes in policy. You take classes in every aspect of social work. You know, we even have to do like statistics and things like that, yeah. Which actually was more interesting when it got into my field than, you know, in undergrad. But the like true, real, like nitty gritty of what it's like to be a social worker in a hospital is there's nothing like experience. And I think like I still have days where I'm like, nobody told me about this in grad school. I mean, like there's things that I don't know how PG you like to keep your podcast, but like nobody tells you about how many older gentlemen don't wear pants.
Oh my God.
And how many of them, I mean, you're in the hospital, so they're wearing gowns, but how many of them, their undercarriage you might see in a day. So things like that.
Monday morning.
Hello. Monday morning. So, but you know, that's kind of the funny aspect of it, but there's a lot of really unique things that happen, and we feel that we could really contribute and add to someone who's new in grad school, and you're like, I really like social work, but I don't really understand what it is. And especially if you're trying to find out what being in a hospital setting's like. And we can, from the day-to-day steps, mm-hmm. of like, sometimes we talk to the legal department, sometimes we're looking up hospital policy, sometimes
and sometimes you're going to see a lot of dongs.
Yes! I he said it, not me. I wasn't sure if I could say it. Some days you're going to see a lot of dongs.
We can give you...
It's a well-rounded approach to what hospital social work looks like.
So if you're wanting to be a medical social worker, we can tell you the ins and outs and what it really is like and how every day is different, rewarding, and sometimes it can be really fun.
Yeah.
So since we're talking about funny things, so other than the Monday morning donks, what other interesting little snippet can you add? Oh. Something that made you think and laugh.
Goodness.
I had more recently a patient who was a schizophrenic on the older side, which is pretty unique because, like, schizophrenics into their 60s is pretty unique. Usually they've stopped taking care of themselves, ticked someone off enough that they've killed them, or they've, like, you know, injured themselves enough by, a lot of times, the when I said pedestrian versus auto, like, I would guarantee that, like, 90% of them have schizophrenia or something like that. But he, I have never laughed so much, and not just with him, when he just, as he was, like, sharing his story, and he knew he had schizophrenia, but just sharing his story, and then I would come back, and he would always call me, because my name's Anne, and, I'd say, you know, it's Anne, and Frank, and then he'd go down this whole tirade of, like, Nazi Germany, and I was like, but every day, it would be some new thing that he'd pick on, and it was so...
As a Jew, that's kind of horrifying.
Right. He was also Jewish, but he would just go down these things, and it's, you know, his, that's where his brain would start. He'd pick the first thing you said to him.
He's just pulling from the ancestral trauma.
Absolutely.
But it would be whatever the first thing you said to him, you knew was going to be the, that's the track we're taking, and it would, it could go all kinds of places. So I would say, you know, he was the most recent thing that definitely made me chuckle a good bit.
I mean, I really have to dig into mine. Usually mine are
fears are intubated and dying. Side.
Mine are usually just waiting to, you know, to knock on heaven's door. So it's, I really have to dig into
you don't get
a
much
funny one. So
you don't get much action.
Maybe
there.
When our podcast comes up, I will have a few at that time.
Well, I can't wait to hear your podcast, and I can't wait to help you with your podcast
yes,
as well.
Thank you.
And I'm going to think that, you know, we're going to wrap up this afternoon. I have totally thank you so much for coming and sharing and being a guest on our show. And we love this uncharted conversation. And I hope we have more in the future. Thank you so much,
absolutely.
Ladies. Thank you.
Thank you for having us. And yay.
All right.